The title of our talk this morning is An Open Hand or a Closed Fist. And as we talk about this, it'll become apparent what I mean by that. We're in James chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. I'm going to start by reading that this morning. James chapter 4, verses 13 to 17. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. The word of the Lord. Like most of you guys, every day at work, I get these Microsoft Outlook calendar invitations. In fact, my day can be full of those things. And when it comes in, you have the option to accept or decline. So I've grown up in the church, so I was always kind of familiar with this passage. Sometimes I've kind of wished that there were a third option that says, if the Lord wills it. I feel like I'd be a better Presbyterian. That's what I grew up a Presbyterian, a better if I could just click that option. Just imagine all these business people getting my responses, if the Lord wills it. Well, are you going to be there? Or are you going to not? But there's some small part of me that feels presumptuous in saying that I'm going to be available at 10:30 next Tuesday morning to talk about a deal. But James is not calling us here merely to window dress an arrogant heart with hollow words. I've known a lot of people in life who say frequently, if the Lord wills it, whenever they're talking about making plans. That might reveal the fact that they have a submitted heart, but it may also just be words. James is calling us more to more than just uttering those words here this morning. The essence of James's teaching here is that Christians must humbly embrace the supremacy and sovereignty of God in their lives. As we look back over James and even look forward in James, it becomes very apparent that James had profound concerns about his readers' relationship with money. In chapter 1, James says that the poor man will be exalted while the rich man fades away. He devoted the first part of chapter 2 to the sin of partiality, which is where people were treating rich people better than they were treating poor people. In chapter 3, he described the false wisdom of the world that involves selfish ambition for possessions, for things, for money, and bitter envy. In the beginning of chapter 4, the chapter we're in this morning, he identifies the desire for material pleasures as the source of quarrels and conflicts among people. In chapter 5, which we'll be getting to in coming weeks, he tells the rich people of the world to weep and mourn because their very riches will serve as witnesses against them. In every chapter of James, he is addressing his readers' relationship with money. So the relentless pursuit of money and the place that money held in James' readers' hearts was damaging the community of the church. It was distracting people from the pursuit of true wisdom, and it was making them, rendering them ineffective in serving God. The passage we're talking about this morning also relates to money. People in the church were arrogantly announcing their plans to engage in business and make a profit. Well, when we take all these references together, it becomes apparent that money was more than just a distraction to these people. In fact, money was an idol. These people were struggling with idolatry. I want us to try and push through this passage this morning because I think there's a hesitancy to identify ourselves sometimes in these things. We want to think that it's talking about someone else, but I think that a lot of us probably need to see ourselves in this passage. The brash, confident individualist, that character is very highly regarded in America. The risk taker, the innovator, the money maker, those are icons of our culture. Business is something that we Americans do or think we do really well. We also play a high value on self-confidence, which was personified in the sort of tough-talking, independent, self-made man. We lionize the person who can take the bull by the horns, wrestle it to the ground, slap his brand on it, and say, look what I did. The same guy might say, I don't wear any man's yoke. I'm a self-made man. Some of us look at that and think, gosh, I wish I could be more like that. Well, today's passage suggests that God might view that person a little differently. James, rather than confident, James might use the word arrogant. Rather than admiring this person's boasting, James would call it evil. It's not evil to take risks, to innovate, or to exercise competence in the world of commerce. In fact, we should all be competent in what we do, working hard in what we do, excelling in what we do the best we can. But it's arrogant to boast in a control that we don't really have. And it's evil to elevate our own ambitions, our own plans, our own intentions above the plans that God has for us. Well, the character that James is describing here might be familiar to us, quite possibly, because we see him in the mirror. We boldly announce what we're going to do, where we're going, and the money we're going to make. We might sort of put a God-honoring gloss on that. We might give some lip service to it, to God's glory. But our plans are our own, as is the money we plan to make from our plans. Now, as common as this is, it is not good. There are certain sins in our, that are prevalent in our culture that I could probably get everyone in this room to rally around and say, yeah, isn't that terrible? Let's throw stones. Let's talk about the evil that's out there. This one's more challenging. This is not one of those sins that just horrifies us. Some sins are so culturally ingrained that we don't recognize them as sin at all. Those are the dangerous ones. But our culture is not what defines the appropriate relationship to money and to plans. Scripture defines the appropriate relationship to money and to plans. We can't lapse into this notion that, well, if it's something my culture calls good, then it's something that I should also call good. According to the Bible, the right thing to do with respect to our plans and our money is to hold them with an open hand, acknowledging that God can put in and take out of that hand as he wills. But the right thing to do isn't the easiest thing to do. In Luke, Jesus used a parable to teach a similar one to the lesson James is giving us in this passage. Jesus said in Luke 12, 18 through 20, then he said to them, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. And he told them a parable, saying, the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what will I do since I have no place to store my crops? Then he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? The man in that parable was prospering. If he were alive today, we might look at that guy and say, whew, that guy's blessed. His chief anxiety was having enough space to put all of his stuff. I've seen a similar anxiety in my law practice. When someone comes into a lot of money, it can be stressful to know where that money needs to go. And in fact, in my world, in commercial real estate, a lot of times, as soon as you get that money, the clock starts ticking for you to reinvest it, or you're going to have to pay taxes on it. And I've had a few deals where we've closed at 5 o'clock on the last day of that exchange period, and it's a pretty stressful thing. But it's ironic because the reason it's stressful is because you've made a bunch of money and you now have to pay taxes on. But you might be surprised. Or some of you have experienced it. It can be really anxiety producing to come into significant wealth. Well, the man in this parable had no idea that his life was about to be extinguished. What use would those barns of grain be to the dead man who left them behind? Now, the Bible's teaching on money doesn't mean that we shouldn't plan. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't work. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be wise with our money. In fact, there's a great deal of biblical instruction about how we should be wise with our money. But to a far greater degree than we appreciate, the Bible teaches that money has a profound and dangerous propensity to corrupt our hearts. Many of us are guilty of looking to money rather than to God to provide for our needs. The level of passion and vigor and trust that we give to money, that level of passion and vigor and trust should be reserved for God alone. But most of us don't hold our money with an open hand. We hold it with a closed fist. Holding tightly to our money and to our plans is sowing to the flesh. Paul talks about the fruit of sowing to the flesh versus the fruit of sowing to the spirit. Sowing to the flesh produces fruits of idolatry, enmity, strife, dissensions, factions, and envy. Sowing to the spirit, which would in this context look like treating every tomorrow as a gift from God, every dollar that he puts in our hand as is really ultimately his to give, to take. Sowing to the spirit produces love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Our love for money, which is the very thing that we think is going to deliver us joy and peace, is the thing that is keeping us from joy and peace. Because we're investing our hopes in something that cannot deliver on that promise. Well, you might ask, what should that rich guy have done with his crops? I've asked myself that question as I've read this. It's like, the guy had a bunch of crops, he needed bigger barns, what was he supposed to do? He probably should have given away the excess. His existing barns were likely sufficient to store reasonable reserves for the year to come, and he could have trusted in God to provide for the years that came after that. That's a hard thing for us to do. We want to say that we trust in God. We want to use our lips to say, I trust in God, but we want to have plenty of cash that we don't really have to trust in God. This rich man's greatest sin was not in building bigger barns, though. His greatest sin was in having a life that consisted of his possessions. Possessions were his passion, his God, the thing in which he placed all of his trust. Note the rich man's own words that condemned him. Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Even as we read that, so Jesus is giving that as a negative example, but let's be honest, we read that as like, I'd kind of like to have enough that I could take my ease and eat, drink, and be merry. That sounds awesome. This man was looking to material possessions to give him spiritual sustenance. Acquisition was his life orientation. The rich man was holding on to his life with a closed fist. But Christ calls us to the opposite approach, to the open-handed approach in Matthew chapter 16. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must. This is not an option. If you're going to follow Jesus, you must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels and will repay every man according to his deeds. The Apostle Paul also described this open-handed approach to life in Colossians 1:27. Now I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake. And in my flesh, I do my share on behalf of his body, which is the church, in filling up what is lacking in Christ's afflictions. Man, can we rejoice, as Paul rejoiced, when our plans are thwarted? I'm a planner. I love to plan, and I love to have a predictable set of events coming up. I like to kind of put vacations on the calendar and have those to look forward to. I like to know when the deals I've got are going to close. I like to kind of have my financial projections in order. I like to plan. And a lot of times when my plans get upset, which they often do, I can find myself lapsing into despair. I long to have the heart of Paul who can say, I rejoice in my sufferings. Paul was able to rejoice because he acknowledged God's supreme role in his life. His driving passion was to proclaim Christ in service to Christ's body, which is the church. Do we share Paul's passion, or does the desire to serve ourselves consume us instead? A life lived in service to self is ultimately going to bring despair instead of fulfillment. A lot of you have probably read Christian biographies, stories about significant people in the faith who may have been missionaries or theologians or people who happen to go through historically significant events, persevering for their faith. Think of some of those stories. How many of those stories of significant lives involve the uninterrupted completion of well-laid plans? Probably none of them. How many of those stories involved life events that we would never want? All of them. We learn the open-handed approach to life through suffering. Without suffering, we can easily conclude that the best things in this life are just the fleeting things of this earth. Only in the cauldron of suffering do we recognize that there must be something higher, better, and more enduring than the hollow promises of this world. The application of today's passage involves a whole lot more than just simply saying, if God wills it. I'm going on spring break next week. I guess I could stand here and say, I'm going to spring break if God wills it, and sound really pious. But is my heart sufficiently yielded such that if that plan were to be unwound, I could receive it with grace, knowing that I need to hold it with an open hand because God clearly has some other intention for me? James calls us to genuinely submit our plans to God. This requires the subordination of our goals to God's intentions for us. It includes more than simply praying about our plans. I mean, I think all of us, we can lay plans and we can pray about those plans and make it look like we're pretty righteous. But it also involves not despairing when our plans are involuntarily changed. The open-handed approach to life requires faith because we have to trust the one who puts in and takes out of our open hand. We do not know whether we have a tomorrow on this earth. But if we have one, let's go forward with the open-handed attitude of openness to God's plans instead of with the closed-fisted approach of demanding what we think is ours. We might be surprised if we were to do that because it feels unnatural. We want to close our fists on whatever God has put in so that we can hold on to it tightly because we think that our security is in those things. It might seem unnatural, but if we were to release that and allow God to put in and take out in his time as he wills, we might be surprised to experience the joy that flows from genuine dependence on a good God. Everything we are and everything that we have is God's, including our money and including our tomorrows. It's not a cause for despair. It's a cause for rejoicing because we serve a good Father who has gladly chosen to give us an eternal kingdom where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. If you're suffering today, this morning, because of frustrated ambitions, failed plans, I ache for you, I do, but I encourage you to rejoice as Paul rejoiced in his suffering, because tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance brings about proven character, and proven character brings about hope, and a properly placed hope does not disappoint. So my nugget this morning, because some of you might be listening to this and say, well, I get that, it sort of resonates with me, but I don't know what it really means in my life. What am I supposed to do? What can I do to have this heart that James talks about, that Jesus talked about, that Paul talked about? A simple thing that I think that all of us should be engaged in doing is identifying people who are less fortunate than us, whatever that population might be. There's no shortage of that. And I identify a particular group or cause and give sacrificially of both your time and your money to serving those people. There's something about that exercise of giving freely of those things that we cherish, of our time and our money, to people who struggle, who are less fortunate. Thus, it humbles us. It allows us to see God's hand at work. I give you this this warning. It can often be frustrating. I mean, a lot of times the people that you're trying to serve, they're in that situation because they've perhaps made some poor choices. They've got some you know, trauma and things in their lives, and it can be difficult because we expect to go in and sort of be this wonderful sort of savior to these people and everything's set right. Usually when you do this, you're in it for the long haul. And that's part of that process of us being sanctified in that. That's how we really take on this heart. We begin to see, begin to take on that heart of the Father who is so patient with us and bears with so many of our failures. And when we are in that position of being able to serve people who are less fortunate, it's not simply to build up our ego, but we can be unlike the man who just simply stored up his barns to serve himself. We can be more like a man who opened the doors of those barns to serve others with an open hand instead of a closed.